Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Nightlight. Step away from the mainstream and gather around as we enlighten the world and our realities and travel this cosmic journey we call life. Join us as we share with you and provide that beacon that can guide us all to a better way. Explore with us as we examine a metaphysical montage of spiritual insights, covering everything from the mundane to the magical, UFOs to unicorns, and everything in between. This is a time of awakening, of sharing and evolving, of spreading our wings and soaring on the cosmic breath of creation. Come and join with other light-minded spirits as we weave our lights together to seek understanding, enlightenment, and with a little luck, some wisdom. This is Nightlight, a reminder that you are never alone.
I hope everyone is having a great week. Okay, I just wanted to give everyone a reminder. The AAPS conference is this weekend in Harris, Michigan. If you need to get a little bit more information about that conference, you can go to aapscopper.com. We have a return guest who will be discussing his new book, and we may even get a lesson on how to make goat cheese. Barbara and I are very pleased when an author contacts us and says, oh, hey, you know, have a new book coming out, and, we try to quickly book them, and that's what happened with tonight's show. Richard Thornton is an architect and city planner. He has written several books on Native American history and culture in Georgia, and he continued those themes in his latest publication, Native American Encyclopedia of Georgia. Hi, Richard. How are you?
I am just fine. How are you doing tonight?
Oh, great.
That sounds like a very boring town. That's a very interesting book. But
I liked it. We're gonna let everyone know how interesting this book is. So, okay. Maybe some of the list, the listeners were getting ready to tune into tonight's show, perhaps they went to YouTube and listened to Merle Haggard's Okie from Muskogee or Saturday. They're going to be, tuning in to hear all the important scores coming out of Tallahassee and Tuscaloosa. So, those town names sound like they're Native American, and there's probably an ancient town there, but are those really the names of the towns? So Richard is going to give us some insights into the native languages of all these different cultures that put their spin on it. So those town names really aren't the original words. So, we're going to have a lot of fun looking at the evolution of these words, or talk about mounds and the grave goods and transatlantic crossings and geographical features from Georgia. So just kick back and enjoy the next couple hours. We're going to have a lot of fun, learn some new stuff. So, Richard, you make it very apparent that there are a lot of mistranslations and inaccuracies by the English and Spanish explorers. Let's kind of look at what time period are we looking at where this start, the misinterpretations started, the maps that you present. So let you take over from there.
Sure. I think the first case of a major boo-boo in interpreting a Native American word is Appalachia. When the first Spanish explorers hit the Florida Peninsula, they asked where would the gold come from. They said, they pointed to the north, and they said it's 2 weeks north among the Appalachians. They have lots of gold. And so you look at the maps from the 1500s and 1600s, and the mountains of North Georgia are labeled the Appalachia or the Appalachian Mountains. Appalachian is just the plural of Appalachia. But, and then of course, the Georgia Mountains have the purest gold in the world. We still have gold here. So that all makes sense, except that when the DeSoto expedition entered Florida, first near Bradenton, which is south of Tampa, and then they kind of cut diagonally to the northeast across northeastern Florida, then cut back west, they encountered a town named Appalachian. And so then they assumed that the name of the entire tribe in the area around Tallahassee was the Appalachia. And of course, they didn't understand any of the language of the Appalachia. We're telling them, no, that's not us, that's just a village. What Appalachian was a trading village of the Appalachians in North Georgia. And so here we have today, 500 years later, everybody thinks that the name of the tribe down in northwestern Florida was Appalachia. They never called themselves that name. And they are totally unaware that the most advanced Native American culture north of Mexico were the Appalachians of northeast Georgia, who were really extremely advanced. They looked like people from South America. In fact, they spoke a language that mixed Mexican and Peruvian words, and they gave us the name Appalachian Mountains. There's also where they live is called the Appalachia River in northeast Georgia, but they're totally left out of the history books. Yet they were the most advanced people of all, and they were the ancestors of the Creeks. When the British first settled Savannah, the Creeks said, our name is Appalachia or Palachi, and the British ignored them. They'd call them Creeks. So that's just one word, and of course that has a major impact on the geography of the United States, because originally Appalachian, which is the plural of Appalachia, was just the mountains in North Georgia where the gold belt is, but over time it moved farther and farther north, where now it's the name considered set by everybody that it's the name of the eastern mountains of North America. A major impact on the geography of the day. That's just one small example. I mean, I could go on. I think it was like 423 words I translated in my book. So, just endless possibilities of discussing the ramifications of history. So where would you like to go next?
Okay. There are, you start the your book off by discussing some of the dictionaries, Native American dictionaries. I never knew that those existed. You know, you're working from some of them. There were just a lot of people who really didn't know what they were doing.
Yeah.
So some were better than others, but
basically, all the books, almost all the books except by Galt in Georgia, are just taking folklore and repeating it as if it's fact.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't really research the words themselves. They just wrote down what someone else said in the past. And there's an
mm-hmm.
exception. There are two more recent books in Georgia from the 1960s and 70s where they actually got Creek dictionaries. But where they got in areas where it was not Muscogee Creek language, which is most of Georgia's not Muscogee Creek, it's Issitee Creek, they couldn't translate the word. And so they just guessed. And so, again, they did not realize how many different Indian cultures settled in Georgia. I eventually used, I think it's 24 dictionaries to translate the place names. A tremendous number of people from long distances settled here and gave their name to at least one place in the location of the state. It was kind of a crossroads.
You do say that, there's Albert Thomas Gatchett. His Smithsonian book was, fairly accurate Creek Dictionary. But there's also statements that you make, like all the translations were accurate, but the information never reached the communities whose names had been translated. In fact, as will be discussed later, his accurate translations were evidently ignored by other staff members in the Bureau of American Ethnology. So, clerical errors like that just compound the issues early on.
It also affects how archaeologists are interpreted sites, because they relied, if the Bureau of Ethnology said this is what this word means, it also affected how they interpret who lived at that site. So it created a lot of problems.
Yeah,
and again,
and
Gatchett, though, he did not realize that there were many other ethnic groups here. And so some of his translations are wrong, where he tried to make a word that was not Creek into a Creek word. So it didn't dawn on that so many people from so many parts of the Americas could actually settle here and had communities. So he was right when he translated Muscogee Creek words, but he got farther and farther off from being right when he tried to translate non-Muscogee words.
Yeah, and since you were talking about ethnology, and you also write, first, the Muscogees were originally a minority in Georgia. Many of the Creek place names are not Muscogee words, but are derived from other Creek languages. Secondly, he assumed that all place names from Atlanta northward were Cherokee. And you say there are very few Cherokee place names in Georgia. Now, I did not know that until I read your book,
actually, there are very few Cherokee place names in North Carolina either, or Tennessee. It's just fascinating that all the rivers in western North Carolina have Creek names, or else English names. So it's a problem that extends beyond the state's boundaries. I think what I'll do is I'll give an example of what got me started in all this, so you understand how it does affect the belief system of archaeologists. Back in 2007, I was contacted by the American Museum of Natural History in New York City. They asked me to create architectural drawings of Mission Santa Catalina de Guali, which was on St. Catherine's Island on the coast of Georgia. very famous Spanish mission. But they also wanted to make sure I did it right, so they sent me a box full of archives, photocopied archives from the Spanish colonial library in Seville, Spain. And then they also sent me archaeological reports, and I started noticing that these archaeologists working on the coast of Georgia were calling words that were definitely not Creek words, Creek words. They talked about the people on the coast speaking another dialect of Creek. Well, they know they were not, absolutely not Creek words. And it took me years and years and years. We're talking about 2007 to when I wrote this book, to be able to translate their words. I kept on going farther and farther away, purchasing dictionaries to find one that would translate those place names on the coast. And it turned out that most of the people on the coast were from South America. And that drastically changes one's interpretation of what the artifacts you found. And also found that you're familiar with the Taino of the Caribbean. They had a major presence in Georgia, Alabama, and Tennessee. Tennessee actually means descendants of the Taino. So in other words, they were up in Tennessee too.
Okay.
What other books say is Tennessee is believed to be a Creek word meaning unknown. Well, that's because they didn't follow it far enough, you know, to get to the, why did the Creeks call that land Taino Sea, you know, Taino Sea, and it was called this, where the Tainos lived.
Oh, that is starting to put things into perspective.
Yeah.
Okay, so, and you know, you just mentioned, you know, one of the phrases you just mentioned was from the coast of South America. So,
yeah. Well, they actually came beyond the coast of South America. There's people from eastern Peru and the Amazonian basin settled in the southeast.
Yeah, and yeah, so. That's one of the subjects our listeners really enjoy are, you know, these transatlantic or long-distance migration-type stories. So, yeah, we need to address the how much of this South American influence has been found in Georgia, and you know, you do have in your book, you know, it was also going the other way as well. So, you know, Richard, could you give us a little bit more background on the Mayan language?
That's a language distinct from what was spoken by most of the Mayas in the Yucatan Peninsula. And the Itzamayas probably came from somewhere else earlier, but over time they picked up some Maya words and it blended with their old language. They probably were from, say, Ecuador, Peru, right there originally, but they became the foundation that built on top of an earlier immigration by people from Peru. So the culture of the Creeks was really a mixture of Peruvian and southern Mexico, and that's exactly what my DNA is. I have no North American Indian DNA. All of my indigenous DNA is either from southern Mexico, or basically they call it Maya, Pernoan from eastern Peru, or Sami from northern Sweden. And, you know, it's a different culture that might explain why they were building large pyramidal mounds and cities when Native Americans other parts of North America were living a more hunter-gatherer type life. They were from a different people. I got a better story than that. You know, you're talking about South America. Now, this is going to blow some people's mind. This is one of the biggest puzzles I've ever had, linguistic puzzles I've ever had in my life. One of the most powerful tribes on the Altamaha River, which is one of the largest rivers in eastern North America. Most people don't know that. I think it's third largest in North America, in the east, on the east coast, was the Alemanni. And what the French colonists at Fort Caroline said is that they grew trees, the quinine tree, cinchona tree, And then they'd gotten very wealthy by selling the bark of the cinchona tree all over the southeast because it cured malaria and it cured many other diseases. Like when I had a tick infection about 30 years ago, I had to take quinine pills. So it was a cure-all medicine. They got very wealthy from this bark. And I said, that name, it just doesn't... I got dictionary after dictionary after dictionary, both in North America and South America. Nothing matched it. Because we knew the meaning of the word because the gentleman who was captain of Fort Caroline, René de Laudière, wrote that it meant medicine people or medicine men. And I said, I can't find anywhere in South America where it's like except that the Creek word for doctor is alec. So that kind of matches it, you know, like alecmani. So the Creek modern word for doctor is a healer is alec. So that's that part. But the mani is nowhere in South America could I find a mani meaning people or men or anything like that. And then I remembered there's a bunch of tribes in northwestern Germany who are the ancestors of the Angles and the Saxons whose name would be like Germani, Alemani, Stomani, and that's, wait a minute, no, that couldn't possibly be. They couldn't have come from Germany, but actually Alecmani is an archaic English word meaning medicine nobility or medicine men. Mani is the plural of man in Old English. So among the many people who settled on that coast was probably a boatload or several boatloads of people from what was then southern Denmark, the ancestors of the English. Now, how about that?
Very interesting. And you also mentioned that there are some Gaelic Irish words
found in
the native languages as well. So if people are traveling from Denmark, England, it's not all that far to Ireland. So it's possible. So what is some of the evidence of Irish or Gaelic words?
Okay, the most important is Gi, which is the word for people or tribe. It's used as a suffix in Iroquois, Algonquin, Shawnee, Cherokee, and Muscogee. It's in all those languages that's straight Irish, but I've also found that several of the tribes who became members of the Creek Confederacy actually had the same name as traditional Irish Gaelic tribes in Ireland. And their names are on the landscape today. Like the Tuca, who were originally up and around Highlands, North Carolina, through there, Sapphire Valley, that means principal. And it's a word used today in modern Gaelic. Principal, that means principal people. The Currahee, like Currahee Mountain near Toccoa, Georgia, that is the Curry, which is the modern day name of Curry and McCrory and all those Irish names from that same root. That was a tribe in the thing. And then in the southwestern part, County Kerry, that's, of course, Kerry is a very common Irish name. That is, there's also a division of the Creeks that had that name too. And so they were. It's amazing. It's hard to believe, but I mean the words are there, and it all matches. Syntax and everything, it has the same meaning. It's just probably what happened is groups, fairly small groups of people immigrated from both Ireland and maybe Scotland and certainly from southern Scandinavia, and they intermarried with indigenous Americans. So over time, they just look like full-blooded American Indians, but their roots are people who arrived with new ideas and new energies that became a tribe around that. That's a lot of Native Americans take that hard to believe that they're not pure-blooded American, but when you look at the genetics, it's very hard to find any American Indian with more than around 38 to 40% American Indian DNA. Everything else is from other parts of the world, which to me is telling us that they carry their mixed blood people and that the Native Americans really are a new race created by people from many places.
Well, and you know, we cannot rule out trans-Pacific arrivals as well.
No, I'm part Polynesian. And it's not just me, it's my whole family. In fact, what's really weird is that our Polynesian is labeled Maori, you know, the people of New Zealand, which may mean that they came here first and then went on to settle New Zealand, because I think they were here before they were in New Zealand. I mean, how else do you explain the substantial Polynesian DNA? As though they were here. Now, also, we should say that my coordinator, fellowship in Mexico, Ramon Piñachan, told me that they thought Polynesians came to Mexico before American Indians, and that definitely the tribes located between Los Angeles and the tip of Baja California were Polynesians. And this has been documented now. They've been able to do DNA tests on their skeletons, and they were Polynesians. There's also Polynesians in southern Mexico. When they came, they don't know. But, you know, he believed that it was not a radical idea, that they just saw the cultural influences of the Polynesians on the Americas, and then they saw skeletons that were definitely not American Indian skeletons. They were Polynesian skeletons. They'd find them, you know, in certain sites. So they were convinced that those people came also.
Okay. Well, and, you know, you may know Rick Osman, or at least heard of Rick. He has the book Graves of the Golden Bear, and he argues that like the 9th Roman Legion was pulled off of building Hadrian's Wall. There's evidence that they came to the Ohio River Valley, probably settled more around the Louisville Falls of the Ohio area, then they kind of reappear like 25, 30 years later. But if we go with Rick's theory that there were actually Romans here, it could explain why we do have words like aqua for water. Mm-hmm. In the native language, I thought that was an interesting section of your book. It fits in with
theories. I really don't. I mean, you know, I got my critics will say, well, that's just your theory. I don't have any theories. I just follow the evidence where it is. So I'm not going to say that just because you find Roman coins in a cave in Kentucky, they have to be the 9th Legion. And in fact, the 9th Legion shows up on the German frontier several years later, so they didn't come here. But what I have found that you cannot deny with is that there are 6.5 pages of words associated with water in the Muscogee Creek Dictionary that have as their root the Latin word for water, aqua. But aqua is not the word for water in Muscogee. Then the actual word used by the Muscogee Creeks for water is Uwa, I pronounce it either Uwa or Uwe. Well, that's Illyrian from the other side of the Adriatic Sea from Italy. In fact, I'm finding a lot of Illyrian words at the core root of Muscogee that's not in my own Creek language, which is Isshiti. Isshiti is basically a dialect of, it's a Maya. It's a Maya language. But the Muscogee Creek language, I was finding all these words that were root words from Illyrian. So I wrote a friend of mine, Dr. Don Yates, who's a geneticist and owns the DNA Research Incorporated. And I said, am I crazy? But I'm finding that at the core of Muscogee are Illyrian and Latin words. And he said, no. He said, that's exactly what we're finding genetically, that they're tracing the core of the oldest genes in the Muscogee Creeks to Illyria. And he said, there's a reason that that was the homeland of the sea peoples. I don't know if you're familiar with the story, but they were kind of like pirates, invaders, that they destroyed most of the Bronze Age civilizations in Eastern Europe and actually ruled India for a while. So in what we have in Georgia is a lot of ethnic groups near the coast that when you translate the word, it means sea people or ocean people. So it all ties in. It does not make any sense logically, but again, there's no other explanation for these foreign words from the other side of the Atlantic meaning the same and being pronounced the same. If they were just, you can't say just because bat means a bat, bat in English means the same thing as bat in Maya, because bat in Maya means boy. And in English it means like a baseball bat. It says you can't just pick up two sounds the same. It has to be the meaning and the sound, and they mean the same on both sides of the Atlantic. I can't explain it. I have no explanation how this occurred. I'm just telling you that the history as we're being taught in school is far too simple and not very accurate. There's too much evidence that the past in North America is very complex, involved mixing of peoples, movements of peoples, vital societies that were undergoing change. They were not the staid, conservative societies that are painted in anthropology books that stayed in the same place all the time for 2,000 years. That was definitely not the case. And it's also not the case they were pure American Indians. They were mixed in with a lot of other people.
Okay. Well, you do mention that someone described, hold on a second, I'm just trying to get to the right page, that Takahali is a Muscogee Creek word for freckled.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so, okay, even
yeah,
though, you know, we may...
Tokelet, yes.
Okay, thank you for correcting me.
I stopped there, and for many years, I said, well, Tokelet, because the le is actually re. When a Native American pronounced R-E, it sounded like L-E to Englishmen. So when you see an L-E at the end of the word, it's really R-E. R-E is the very, very pre-Indo-European word for a kingdom or a tribe, and for king. Like the word for king in Spain is rey. Well, it's derived from R-E, which was for a kingdom or a nation, a very ancient word. And it's really found all over northwestern Europe, all the way to Scandinavia. So Tokere means, I said, well, Ray, okay, what does toka mean? Well, that doesn't make any sense. It turns out toka means principle, so it means principal people in Gaelic, modern Irish Gaelic. You said toka ray, it would be oh. Or you could say toka gay, which means the same thing. It means principal people.
Well, it's just very interesting that freckled people with reddish brown hair.
Also very tall. They were Scots.
Yeah.
The Tuckabachee Creeks. They became known as the Tuckabachee, which means the descendants of the Toco people. and they were known for being very tall, very brawny, and with reddish brown hair. So they were a mixture of Native American and Scots. And their areas of Northern Ireland and Western Scotland where these Scottish guys mm-hmm. are brutes. I mean, they're big. They're giants. Very powerful. And that's what the Tocco were known for, being tall, freckled, very muscular, and the most ferocious soldiers in the Creek Army.
We may not have, we do have DNA evidence, but, we don't have a skeleton that was unearthed that has, my name is Sean O'Grady from Ireland, a little placard on his chest, but the descriptions of freckled red-haired people just kind of points to one group, one certain area of the world. It's just through language or the languages that you are getting back to the roots to deciphering, you are showing that there were transatlantic migrations, but with people coming from Tabasco province and Mexico and other Guatemala and other places in Central America. What was the reason for all these people arriving in Georgia over thousands of years? What's attracting all these international visitors to various places in Georgia?
Obviously, it's still around because, the Atlanta airport is the busiest airport in the world, and it's a crossroads. And I think that was just a creature of geography was a major factor. Just the shape of the lands and the ocean and the continents caused people to cross there. There were paths to crossing, just like here where I live in the Coochie Valley. We have three or four major trade paths that intersect here. The second thing, of course, in North Georgia was the gold and the diamonds and the sapphires and the rubies. But most importantly, it was the purest gold in the world. And they said in olden times, they just picked it up off the ground. It was kind of like a fairy tale land where you can get rich by just picking up gold as you walked along the floor of the forest and take it back home and sell it.
Okay. And just to show that history repeats itself, Atlanta, was it Hartsfield Airport, the busiest airport in the world. You do go into detail about Peachtree Street in downtown Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
My one trip through Atlanta was whatever interstate that was to take me to Hartsfield Airport. But, I was probably close to Peachtree Street, but I was not actually on it. But what's the importance of Peachtree Street?
It gets its name from a creek town called Standing Peachtree that was up on the Chattahoochee River, northwest corner of Atlanta, and it the road, the trail that went to Standing Peace Tree was a principal trading trail that interconnected the Appalachian Mountains with Florida. And so that's why Peachtree Street developed as the main drag through town during the 1800s, and then now it's more of a historic and a prestige address for companies building large buildings. But it just gets its name from a town that was where several trade routes crossed.
Yeah, so it was just a very important trading path.
That's all it was.
Yeah, I just think it's interesting what you said. It's like, you know, the more things change, the more they stay the same type thing. History repeats itself. You know, I thought that was like one of the best examples. The street probably hasn't, in the actual direction of the street probably hasn't changed in hundreds, if not, you know, thousands of years, but, you get some, buildings lining it now, but overall, it's probably the same thing as it has been for hundreds of years. I just thought that was really fascinating. And, we also have examples of, some Hebrew words that have been detected in the native languages, and some of that's like you're actually setting up a show in a couple weeks with David Brody, but story you have on page 42 about Liube.
Let's look it up here. I'm getting my book out here.
Yeah, it's on page 42, and also again on 49. See, I actually read.
I'm impressed. You know something scary about this book? I wrote it when I had COVID. I had COVID before they knew what the name, didn't have a name for it, and I had no idea what's going on. But I had fits doing the book because I had the encephalitic form that came in through as an eye infection. In fact, that's what most of the people in this area had, was eye infection and severe brain headaches and infections. And so I had trouble remembering, and I would type, and I would forget what I was typing, literally. So that's my excuse for having to look up my own book, what you're talking about. 42.
42 and 49.
Now, I'm not sitting out at all. That's, don't tell anybody that. It's just the COVID, see? Okay, Luby. Oh, Luby. You're talking about the Jewish girl. Oh, yeah, that's a good story.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, Luby is means love. It's a Ashkenazi Jewish name, primarily, sometimes used by Sephardic. It was most common in Eastern Europe, and it was generally the name given to the firstborn daughter of a rabbi. Now, she put next to it 1715. That's highly significant because that's the Yom HaShoah War in which all whites were being killed in the Southeast. So evidently, Luby was on the run. Either she'd already been captured and she was going to be held as a slave, or she was not captured, and she was running from the Indian war parties and was just leaving a message to tell people that's where she was, or she'd been through there.
Okay, and what she also left her initials at the Track Rock Gap.
Well, that's where she left them.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to understand that at that time, there were many traders living near the Indians, and there were also gold miners near Track Rock, and most of the gold miners and the traders were Jewish. So that's, it had been very likely that they were escaping. She'd already captured and they killed the men. They just didn't kill the girls, and everybody was running when they got word that the whites were being killed. And the reason I know it's probably a girl is that she didn't know how to write N or U. She got it backwards, and this indicates she wasn't fully educated in English. So I just suspected that she was a, and also being a younger girl, she'd be less likely to be scalped. They did scalp women. They're more likely to keep an adolescent or child as a slave.
Okay, well,
they make a good movie. You have a free hand with it. You know, the writers could come up with a million different plots of the story behind that rock. But it'd be an interesting movie. It's a part of history that's not even mentioned in our textbooks, but of the fact that we had so many people, in particular of Jewish heritage, living in the Appalachians during the 1600s. And one of them, Luby, who was on the run or else was captured, worrying that she might be scalped at any moment.
No, it really is a fascinating story. One of my friends does have books on basically white Indians, settlers captured as probably children. They were, spent maybe the next 10 years in the Shawnee tribe, and some treaty, say at Fort Pitt, where the kids were supposed to be returned, and they didn't want to go back to their families. They prefer to stay with the native families that raised them. So I'm working, trying to find a date for that author. But what you're saying, I've encountered that. Hopefully, I can get a show before the end of the year on that topic.
It'll be interesting.
With Alan. But yeah, it really is a fascinating subject. Since we are talking about the track rock gap, we spend a little bit of time talking about the many geographical features in Georgia. It looks, the track rock gap just looks like it should be some major ceremonial place. You have a distant mountain between, a saddle of two other mountains. It just looks like a very panoramic, scenic type place.
It is in its winter. The views from top are absolutely incredible. I mean, it should be a national park. But I have to tell you this: the way that both the Isiti and the Chontal Mayas expanded their territories, they would establish fortified trading posts in mountain gaps, and then go up the mountain above it with terraces. So it is a classical Isiti Creek colony, where they go to a key mountain gap on a trail, and then they build terraces above it for producing food, and they put soldiers in fortified positions near the trail so everybody has to pay a tax coming through their land. And over time, they built small towns and then larger towns of supply with all the produce of the land.
Okay. I've just been. You have some great photos in there.
Thank you.
And I thought Indian Springs was another really fascinating place as well. Let's get,
okay, I can. The people outside of Georgia will have no idea what you're talking about, but Indian Springs is roughly in the center of the state. It's just north of Macon. It was considered very sacred to the Creeks, but it's not a regular springs. It's basically a river coming out of the ground. It's that scale. It's not. I've seen some places like that in Michoacan, Mexico, that are of the scale of that. But that's the only place in the world I've ever seen entire rivers just coming out of the ground and forming a series of waterfalls. Well, no one has been able to translate the name of the creek coming out of Indian Springs, and it took me several years, but I finally figured it out. Let's get it in here. Get my book here.
It's on page 153.
I thought it was earlier. I was going to tell you the meaning of the original name for Indian Springs.
Well, it's on 152 and 153. It is a state
park. That's
Indian
Springs itself. I'm trying to get the name of that strange and untranslatable stream through there. Let's see. This is a large book, folks. It's not a pamphlet, because it is an encyclopedia where I tried to cover as thoroughly as possible all the place names and all the general tricks of history that I've learned through the years so I could pass it down to subsequent generations.
You did a great job. It's very informative. You know, I just touch on a number of things to let the listeners know, what's happening, like the Indian Springs State Park and the Etowah Mounds. You know, we'll get to that, and Colomoki Mounds, mm-hmm. Rock Eagle. You know, we'll just touch on a little bit of everything about all this history that is there to explore. Just get out and. If you happen to be in Georgia, make a little day trip and see some of these places.
You know, it's Indian Springs worth seeing. It's the oldest state park in the United States, by the way. It was the first state park. Dates back to the right after the Indian removal. It has a building on it that was built by a Creek leader as a hotel. You don't think about Indians building hotels. But, again, that's what I try to tell people. You can't. The Hollywood mindset of what Native Americans did and didn't do doesn't fit here. It's much closer to Mexico and culturally, although we did not have slavery and we did not have human sacrifice. It seems that when they came up here, the ancestors of the Creeks did away with the worst part of being in Mexico, which is mainly slavery, chronic warfare, and human sacrifice. In fact, the Creeks had a law that you cannot shed either the blood of a human or an animal within 2 miles of a Creek sacred site or a temple. You don't hear about that. You don't read. That's another one of the things you don't read in history books. Mm-hmm. I found the name of the creek. It's right at the beginning. I was looking too far back. This is the worst. This is on page 67. This is the worst word I ever came across. It took me years and years and years to translate this. It's called Abuthlacusta Creek. It is the original name of Indian Springs and the stream that comes out of it.
There it is.
And there it is. And I had to understand how the whites mispronounce Creek words and how the Muscogee Creeks mispronounce Isti Creek words. And so Abuthlacusta is really a Paracusti. And that's the that is the name used by the people who look like eggheads, supersized heads that you find down in Peru, but also were up here too. You know what I'm talking about? They're very, very tall and had red hair, and they had heads that looked like space aliens. Well, that was their name, the Paracousi. So that means that the reason they considered it sacred is that at some time in the past, these super brainy, super tall eggheads from Peru lived there, had a village there, and I guess they were the rulers or something like that. They obviously, with their brains, they went to the top of the class. And so that's what it means. It took a long time, though. But I had to put my mind in the place of how an Englishman would hear Muscogee Creek and then how Muscogee Creek would hear Initiative Creek and how they would, it would distort how the word was spelled.
Well, Indian Creek sounds like it was a really unique place. You know, kind of like a Mammoth Cave with the you know, just the water, just kind of, and it just seems like unusual natural features like that seem like, you know, there's a good chance that there might be some kind of sacred site in Indian Springs case. You know, the councils of the Creek Confederacy were held there.
Yes. And I imagine there were all types of religious ceremonies held there in earlier days. It's a spectacular site, though. It's not in the mountains. It's, as I said, it's in the Georgia Piedmont near Macon, but the site of having these, it's basically a river, come out of the side of a hill and make a series of waterfalls. It's just very spectacular. It's not your regular spring.
Yeah, there are also, you know, I found that, like, Sapelo Island was another interesting place.
I'm going to have to look that up again.
Yeah, yeah, there islands, I think, are fascinating, and on page 216, you're right. The island was inhabited almost continuously by Native Americans from the Ice Age until the 17th century, and then we get into the comet of 539 A.D. I love stuff like that.
Yeah,
but that island was just a sounds just a very lengthy history. I like how you handled that a little section, and then you worked in the comet.
Yeah, this is another thing that's left out of books, but the scientists are aware of. I just don't understand this. I don't create a lot of this new information except right around where I'm living. I am doing basic research here in Northeast Georgia. But elsewhere, I draw on others, and I found out about the comet through a professional geological website and professional magazine that they discovered that either a comet or a large asteroid hit off the coast of Florida in roughly 538 AD. And then I started looking, and then this is something the geologists didn't bother to do. I don't know why, but I might have thought, well, let's look for see evidence of a tsunami. And sure enough, beginning north of Jacksonville, you see a residue ridge left by a massive tsunami that's up to 85 feet tall now, and it's ellipsoid. What the comet did off the coast of Florida is it destroyed the islands off the coast of Florida. That's why there are no islands from Cape Canaveral northward. They were just the soil was washed and pushed into the mainland. In Georgia is where it left the large debris ridges that are up to 85 feet tall, and they extend up to just near Savannah. I could even pinpoint where the object struck the ocean because of the ellipsoid, because it had a there was enough of curves I could just calculate the original axis point.
Cool. That's some really interesting information. I wasn't aware of that either. When you were talking about the comet and tsunami would have obliterated the islands.
It also would have flooded all of South Georgia. It would have killed everybody. And it was I think it was an asteroid. It was something, a monster. And it produced so much debris that the Maya civilization went into a dark age for 50 years after it hit. So it had an impact on Swift Creek culture disappeared from South Georgia permanently. They were killed by the tsunami. So it had an impact culturally on a wide area of the Americas. But no one mentions it outside of the geology textbooks. You never see it in an anthropology book. They're just not even aware because they don't communicate much with their kindred professions.
Well, it's really interesting story, so how people adapt to catastrophic events. You know, we're covering that on last week's show. Maybe people who were enemies actually have to become friends to survive in such a cataclysmic event. I like stories like that. It's really interesting to see the impact on people and how they react. But we have so many listeners who really enjoy stories about the mounds and what was found in them. Give us a few photos of the statues found at the Etowah mounds. That's another state park. We'll spend a little bit of time talking about the amazing artwork that was found.
Yes, I'll be glad to. We'll do the etymology, since this is about my etymology book. Etowah is the Anglicization of the Muscogee Creek pronunciation Etowah, which means principal town, which is derived from the Ishiti Creek word Itula, which means the same in both Ishiti Creek and Itzamaya, means principal town. Tula is derived from the original name of Tetewakan. So what it's saying is that the people that settled there can trace their roots to Tetewakan. The art there, I'll backtrack so people understand how I know anything about this. I received the first Barrett Fellowship from Georgia Tech, which was for the architecture school, and at the time was meant to fund a full postgraduate degree, equivalent back then around $7,000, it was like $1,000 back then. That was a lot of money back then. It enabled me to spend an entire summer traveling and studying in Mexico under the direction of Dr. Ramon Pena Chan, who was the curator for the Museo Nacional de Antropología de México in Mexico City, internationally famous archaeologist. Well, the first time I was to meet with my coordinators, which was Dr. Pena-Chan and Ignacio Bernal, who was director of the Instituto Nacional de Antropología y Historia, Mexico. So he kind of outranked Ramon at the time. And shortly, I brought with me two books because I was told by the Mexican consul in Atlanta, it's customary in my situation, an academic, to give a book to a professor who's going to help you not be paid for it. And they weren't. It was an extra on their part. Well, Ignacio Bernal quickly figured out I was not from a rich family who was going to donate money to their digs. I was not even a professional architect. I was just an architect student who was even just beginning to learn Spanish. And so he looked at his watch and said, idiotas, and walked away, and I never saw him again. On the other hand, Dr. Pena-Chan liked me. He was part Native American. His mother was Maya. My mother was Creek, and then my father had Creek, too. And so I gave him both books. One book was on the southeastern Native Americans. The other book was on of Georgia. And then I was waiting at the out, and I finished my meeting. We shook hands, and he turned down my syllabus of where I was going. He thought the professors at Georgia Tech were just trying to make a tourist out of me. And in fact, he asked me, "What do you want to be, a tourist, or do you want to be someone who knows how to restore buildings and has a sound knowledge of the history of Mexico?" And I said, the latter. And so they tossed my syllabus from Georgia Tech into the trash can, and I was to come back the next day and pick it up. But that was about the limit right then of my involvement with them. Well, I got to the edge of the bus stop on the plaza, and his beautiful graduate assistant, Alejandra, came running out there, Mr. Thornton, wait. And then she said, Senor Pena-Chan wants to know if you can eat lunch with him. Oh, big gap. And this is like a rock star, or it's hard to explain, or the president of Amazon asked you to have lunch with you. I mean, he's internationally famous. I said, mm-hmm. I said, no, I'm too important to do things like that. No, actually, I did say yes instantly. And so I went back there, and he was intrigued by my books. He said he never knew all this was in the Southeast, and particularly in Georgia. And he came upon the marble statues from Etowah, which are quite famous, the pink marble statues. And he asked me, Ricardo, why do your Indians make marble statues out of Maya slaves? And I didn't know quite how to do that. I didn't know how to answer. Actually, I couldn't answer almost all the questions he asked me that summer. But, you know, that's how you learn. That's how he taught, was to ask questions. And it was a puzzle me for decades as I was through the years. What did he mean by those look like Mayan slaves? And now what I understand he was telling me was that the founders of Etowah were probably commoners and escaped Maya slaves. Mostly males, because he said the pottery was nothing, and Etowah was nothing like what the Maya commoners made. But so it's probably as men fled from Yucatan when there was a revolt or a collapse of a city, and then paddled across to Florida or paddled up the Chattahoochee River and then over to Etowah, and that's how it got started.
Okay. And it was, Etowah was primarily used between, you know, what, about 1000 AD to nearly 1600. And then,
I think it's later than that. That's another story that the exhibits at the museum now do not reflect what the archaeologists discovered in the 1950s. And the reason I know that is that one of them was Arthur Kelly was kind of my first mentor. I did work for him in college, and he's the one that gave me the endorsement that got me the fellowship in Mexico. And then I had his partner was Lewis Larson, who was my professor of Introduction to Anthropology at Georgia Tech. So there's some things in the exhibit are just not right. Like they said, the museum says that the people came to a place where there'd never been a town before around 1000 AD and built a town. Well, they actually found a chain of towns going back to maybe even 800 BC at that same site. And they also found that were humans, there were Creeks living there at the site until the probably early 1700s.
Okay, so it's like many, say, Hopewell sites in the Ohio Valley or greater Ohio Valley, that the Hopewell sites were built on top or very near Adena sites, which are very close to archaic. So it just multiple layers of utilization of a place.
And
speaking of something like that, just crossed my mind. There was that might be a good segue now into where you did write about Coos being one of the principal, had spoken about principal towns, and Coosa was one of the capitals.
That was visited by the Hernando de Soto expedition in the summer of 1540.
Okay, in one of Allen's books that I've been, like the White Indian author, there's a Coos Hawking, Delaware village in Ohio. I was just wondering if that root word of Coos, COOS, showed any kind of connection between like Georgia and Ohio.
Well, the problem is the original, just what she was pointing out at the beginning of the program, the original indigenous American word was Kusha. And that they substituted Kusa, a hard C sound of T-U-S, and so they never, that was kind of a symbolic way, because the English had trouble saying the word Kusha. So it may not be the same word at all between the Coos Hawking and then the word down here.
Okay, I did not know, and I just wanted to ask. I just thought it was very interesting. There is the Pocatelico sample, and there is a Pocatelico West Virginia as well, and there's just more that East Coast similarity in words. It is just really a fascinating subject to see how all these people were. There was a lot of movement.
Yeah, there was. That's what I'm trying to get across to people. It was not these were not conservative societies. So it was constant movement, and the problem is that over the many, many decades, the anthropology professors have created a discipline or body of knowledge that's easy to teach, because it's mainly all they have to do is just put something out, a summary of what you've been reading here, and then just skip what actually happened. And you don't even mention these other people. That's generally what we have in the books. This whole culture is never mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're trying to correct that.
It's a myth. Like you said, it was Coos, the same thing. Well, actually, the word was culture. But that's symptomatic of that, how they erased the cultures of the people who actually were here when the British colonists arrived, and they've pretty soon could have figured out how to use cannon, I think, and pointed it at the British ships.
I don't like the idea of just making people just suddenly disappear. That's one of the most recent examples is the Land O'Lakes butter, where the Native Grills now disappeared from the logo.
No, I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think the logo was offensive at all, but
I guess maybe somebody
up there in Minnesota thought so.
I didn't find it offensive. I don't know why that was done, but she's gone. I just don't like that idea of we make people that the elite think that they are beneath them. We just make them magically go away. I'll save that for another show. But that Rock Eagle Mound is I've seen photos that it pops up every once in a while. It's like one of the best examples of rock mounds. But you could give us a little bit more detail about that, and spend a little bit of time talking about that.
Okay, it's actually the two mounds. They call them the Rock Eagle and the Rock Hawk, and I don't think they are. I think those are Appalachian shrines, and the reason I do is the Rock Eagle Hawk and the Rock Hawk, I think they call it, have white quartz on top of it. That's a key indicator of a Appalachian shrine. They put the white rock on the top of everything, both mounds and terrace complexes. So, and another thing to be known is that the people in Mexico would, in the southwest called Guerrero province, they had a religion in which they worshiped vultures and the dead, and they would put their dead on top of these stone cairns in the same manner that the Buddhists in Tibet do today, and the hawks and eagles and vultures of Tibet, Himalayas and that sort of area in Tibet, would eat the flesh of these bodies. So I think that's what was going on down in Mexico. Possibly even they put bodies on top of the belly of the Rock Eagle and let the vultures come down and eat the flesh.
Yeah, that seemed to be, then they'd, pretty common during, Adena times.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
You just have the bones to bury at some point after they're the flesh. But, you have a really nice aerial photo of it. There's with the beak points directly
mm-hmm.
south. So there is, seems to be some kind of implied archaeoastronomy feature to that site. And the tail is aligned with the winter solstice sunset.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Looks like a very neat place.
And the other parts that interest you, you can go outside of Georgia. Of course, that's the focus of the book, but I have my interest levels far beyond just the bounds of the state. Do you have any other questions?
But, since we're speaking about hawks, you know, the vultures. Now I'm trying to look through my notes real fast. During the Trail of Tears fiasco, there was the loss of the vulture type folklore. That's there we go. It's on the next page 210.
Mm-hmm.
The painted vulture was yet another victim of removal of Native Americans from their ancestral lands. So, we do need to take into consideration all the different English and Spanish colonizers, as well as events like the forced removal of people from their homelands, and how much of this language and culture were lost since the people did not have the rock eagle symbol to as part of their culture anymore to go back to. They knew all the inner workings of it, like the winter solstice alignment. How many generations does it take to just kind of work its way out of the consciousness of the people who no longer had access to such a ceremonial place?
Yeah, and they didn't have altars. And what part of the problem was that in the old days, many of the tribes in eastern North America burned off the underbrush of the forest each late winter, when it's dry. And this would kill animals, and so these painted vultures thrived off of eating roasted animals that are found in the forest after a fire. And that didn't cease to occur by the following Christmas. And so you had all types of things mixed in. But basically, the painted vulture could not live where the creeks were relocated, so the climate was not their cup of tea. And so they stayed where their quarry was, and the people went west and found new vultures.
Okay, well, just something for the listeners to consider. It brought up a very valid point, but say with if we're looking at some of the computer graphics, like for example, you had the overhead shot of the Rock Eagle Mound, but you also did a lot of computer graphics of of the actual mound site and where the village was laid out around it. Can you tell us a little bit about the artwork that you did for your book, Native American Encyclopedia of Georgia?
Most of those illustrations came from earlier books. I wrote a book on Creek architecture, I guess about 8 years ago now. Time flies. But I took illustrations from there, and then some of my newer illustrations since then. But basically, I was from the beginning, I was treating Creek as a significant form of architecture, and it is. They were capable of building enormous buildings 200 feet wide, 400 feet long for dances and things like that. So that's what I did. And at that time, I studied the archaeological reports of archaeologists, went on site when I could, and then made notes of where I found things that were significant in the bodies, the physical appearance of the people who lived there. And it varied. Each division of the Creek Confederacy and, of course, the South itself, they had their own architectural traditions. They had their own types of town plans. There just was not one town plan. And you get that effect when you read canned history textbooks or read national journalists, reporters, talking about the subject. They make you think there was just one style of town, but there were many different styles. And each educational system of the young people raised different values for the different divisions of the Creek Confederacy. They had traditions of architecture that were different. They had maybe even different ceremonies. And so that was reflected in the way they did their towns and buildings. Does that make any sense?
Yeah. Explanation. Let's kind of dive into another topic here. You did bring up a interesting point about your discovery of the Creek migration legend, and it was what, nearly lost for just about 300 years into
285 years, I think. Exactly.
Yeah. Let's talk about another aspect of your work to preserve Creek history. What's the story there with the Creek migration legend?
Okay. Relations between the Creeks and Georgia were excellent, especially during the early period. There was, in fact, both leaders of both sides encouraged marriage, which is very unusual for the United States. That both the Creeks and the British leaders encouraged people to marry people of the other race, which is, racist America. That would have been quite revolutionary at the time. James Edward Oglethorpe, who was the supervising trustee for Savannah, invited some members of a village that was adjacent to Savannah, whose chief was Tomochichi, which is written in Tomochichi in English, but it's Tomochichi, and it means trade dog, or roughly it means an itinerant trader. He brought him to England, and he came back, and they sent rave reports of how big and sophisticated England was to the high kings and officials of the Creek Confederacy, and so they sent word they'd like to visit Savannah themselves to initiate a friendship treaty. And so what we have here is a verbatim transcript of the high king of the Creek Indians speaking to the people of Savannah. It was taken in the early form of shorthand and then converted into cursive writing report, and the spelling was double-checked and assisted by Mary Musgrove, who's a very famous Indian woman, also known as Creek Mary in one of the books now being published now. And so she translated the Creek words spoken by the High King to the English, and then especially to the Thomas Christie, who was the secretary for the Colony of Georgia. And they had a thing for each other, too. You could tell there's a little physical attraction between Musgrove and Christie. But anyway, he wrote all these things, and Christie also went around the colony meeting with elders of the various factions of the Creek Confederacy to get a better idea of what their culture was like and what their attitudes were towards English people and the French, who were arch enemies of the English at the time. Does that help you any?
Yeah. Yes. No. And yeah, you know, you just mentioned Mary Musgrove. Yeah, you have an interesting biography of her in your book.
Yeah, she was. She came from royalty. Her title was Hinaha, which means she's was sister of the High King, and that's a Maya word, by the way. It means Sun Lord in Maya, and they had the same office. Was the siblings of the king were the Hinaha. She married a white minister of all things, Thomas Bussenworth, and then later married a traitor named Musgrove and kept her name. So between the two, she had very much immersed herself in British society, and she married high. She was considered royalty, so she married some of the leading men in Savannah, and was able to really get to know the English as people rather than as strangers across the burning field, so to speak.
Okay. Well, I thought it was an interesting biography, and you know, another interesting character was Osceola.
Yeah, Osceola.
Yeah.
He's famous, probably the most famous one of all. He was born in a village on the Tallapoosa River, West Georgia, and then later never saw his white boyfriend, and he tailed around some of his friends and whatever, and let me think what he did.
Well, you say he's a military genius.
Yeah. He was, but it's hard to explain it as he translated into the English of what he was, because it's like his name meant crier of Asi, in other words, he was the person who prepared the sacred black drink, Asi, which is the same word in South America. For it's the same beverage, same name, both places, by the way. So he was not a chief. He was not a chief warrior. And in normal places and times, he would not even be in combat. He was almost like a priest, Asi Yahola. And yet he became the premier warrior and leader of the Seminole in Florida. His mother and him moved down there at some date when they got tired of being close to the whites, and he became an active soldier for the Seminoles, but he was never a chief. He just led the fighters because he was so good at what he did. He was never captured as per se. He was asked to come in to talk a peace treaty and the fort, and came in voluntarily under a white flag, and they put him in iron chains, and he died of a disease while he was imprisoned in Charleston, probably from homesickness, if nothing else.
No, and I think there's a little bit written about him in Brad Sanders' book that, you know, we had him as a guest.
Really?
I think in the spring.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, he's talking about, you know, William Bartram's visits
mm-hmm.
throughout the southeastern colonies. And he has a photo of Osceola's grave in there. Yeah, I think it's at the fort you were talking about. But he also wrote Andrew Jackson's betrayal of his own Creek allies in Georgia is what probably started Osceola on the path to being a hostile.
Yeah, because he was rich. That's where he was living at the time. What happened is that there was a civil war between primarily Georgia Creeks and then primarily Alabama Creeks. It's really between progressives and conservatives. It's called the Red Stick War, and the majority were the progressives. But the Red Sticks, a fort that contained both mixed blood Creek Indians and white people, their relatives and husbands, and they killed quite a few whites, almost 500, maybe more than 500. In the fort, and that caused the United States to come involved in the war. So, in order, Jackson was whipped everywhere he turned as long as he was trying to fight the Creeks of white men, and then he made the comment it takes 40 white soldiers to equal one Creek soldier, and he persuaded the Creeks living in Georgia to come and fight as a separate army under the leadership of a Creek chief. He was combination, I think, of they had Chickasaws, Creeks, Choctaws, and Cherokees in it. And but there was a brigade or a division of the army. But Jackson was losing almost every battle until he had these Indians fighting for him, and they made the difference in him winning. But at the same time, he gave orders to the people back in Georgia to ransack the farms of the Creek soldiers from Georgia that volunteered for him. You know, they came home with their wives dead or raped, and the house wrecked, and fences knocked down, and their livestock dead or stolen.
Okay. Well,
and that's why there was such animosity among the Seminoles. They saw what happened to Creeks who fought for the United States. They were betrayed. You know, their farms destroyed, their wives were killed, and raped, the children were carried off into captivity. And so they said, well, if you even anyone who war even becomes your friend, you eventually destroy, so why be your friend to start with?
Well, that does put a lot of things into perspective. You know, you do have references to all the treaties as well.
Yeah, I mean, I can. It's a book, you know. I have a lot more detail, but I don't think the people listening on the phone will, you know, it's some people be such a boring subject to start with, but me to go down and list all the treaties and things like that. But yes, that did occur.
Yeah,
I'm trying to keep it lively.
Oh, well, speaking of lively, you know, we do have to mention Deliverance and The Walking Dead for those who want a little bit of, you know, the woo-woo mixed in tonight. So we're diverse. We can work in a little bit of everything into these shows. So, you know, The Walking Dead is filmed in parts
Atlanta.
Of it are
actually been filmed a lot. It's filmed in Georgia, and then all the Walking Dead are, and they go up in the mountains sometimes and film. I've watched a bus full of zombies drive past my house when I lived in. But really, I'm kidding. A bus full of zombies turned around my old side road, which is a one lane road called Waters Road near DeLonga. I don't know where they were going, but evidently they were filming a scene somewhere up in the mountains involving about 30 zombies in the mountains. And they'll show up in a lot of places. And of course, in fact, the opening scene of Walking Dead was filmed near DeLonga on the expressway from Atlanta to DeLonga. I don't know if you remember a scene where there's looks like thousands of cars parked on the road, abandoned. That's near DeLonga up in the mountains. Now, Deliverance is a book that was written in the same time I was at Georgia Tech. And the author, and I'm
James Dickey.
James Dickey, exactly, was my English teacher when he was writing the book. Oh, about him, their apple.
I did not know that. He told us about it. Didn't he play the sheriff at the end and,
yes.
and telling Burt Reynolds, we don't want you coming back here, you know, pulling this stuff. How the guy end up Dream. Yeah, he was poking holes through John Voight and Burt Reynolds' story. So he actually appeared in his own a movie version of his own book.
That's true.
There's your English
mainly
teacher.
For our English class to show us slides of the Southeast. I mean, that's the truth. But I thoroughly enjoyed it. He would read poetry, and he liked the coast of South Carolina or Virginia or Georgia or the mountains of the Piedmont, and he would show color slides of places he'd been and then read poetry to it. And that was our English class. I'm not even sure how we got graded. I thought maybe he's got an A. I don't know. But then later on when they were filming Deliverance, I went up there several times with friends from my fraternity, and we watched the filming underway. It was quite impressive.
Which scenes did you watch being filmed?
The canoe scenes when they're going down the gorge at the Chattooga River. They're going down the gorge. Yes, that's amazing. That was scary. They were doing it themselves too. They didn't have money for stuntmen. I could not believe they were sending their own actors down those. It's dangerous waters there. I'm a canoeist myself, but I wouldn't go that place. I mean, the three future A-list actors were you know, they're risking their lives going down there in those canoes. And it's really dangerous. But that was not fake photography. I mean, that was the real thing. What you saw the canoes doing was actually what they did. I don't know if this has anything to do with etymology, but it's of interest to the listeners and viewers.
Yeah.
And, of course, the plot of the book and the movie actually is based on Carter's Lake, in which I was kind of a sleazy little slip of ham of politics. They decided to build an extra lake beneath it that would be pumped back up to the upper lake at night, and that was kind of going to make the economic justification for building the lake. Otherwise, it couldn't be justified. But in the process, they flooded the site of one of the largest Indian towns in North America, Coosa, which was where DeSoto went. You mentioned Coosa earlier.
Mm-hmm.
So much of the language, you hear the men talking, I know exactly what they're referring to, who they're talking about. They're talking about the dam being built and the Indian towns. You know, most people from other parts of the world saw the movie, didn't realize there really was a place like this that was done.
Well, okay. So we get, you know, a behind-the-scenes look at the making of Deliverance.
Yes, that's absolutely.
And The Walking Dead.
I have not watched The Walking Dead being filmed, but I have seen busloads of zombies. And not,
yes.
Have you ever seen has a busload of zombies ever gone past your house?
No.
No, see? I got bragging rights.
Yeah,
people think I'm crazy, but I really did. And
that's taking place in Senoia, Georgia.
Senoia was the mother of a very prominent Creek chief, William McIntosh. You might have heard the name. He was the first Indian to be made a brigadier general in the U.S. Army. He was commanded all of the Indian divisions and brigades that fought in the Creek War at the Battle of Horseshoe Bend. But his mother was named Senoia, and that was where he grew up himself. And so now Senoia is becoming the new Hollywood.
Mm-hmm. That's what he said. The historic preservation in the area, it's an ideal location for...
Yeah, and they have... And then right north of there's Peachtree City, which I helped plan, the planned city. That was one of my first project when I got out of, came back from Sweden from working. And so they have a large planned city of maybe 45,000, 55,000 people now, you know, very modernistic, so they can film scenes from movies there too. And it makes people think they're in California or somewhere. But yeah, Georgia's, that's one of the more interesting things that's happening here is becoming the kind of the new Hollywood. And it's not a joke. I mean, it is becoming the new Hollywood because they can turn around films quicker. And they kept on making movies when COVID started. They just, what they did is they did daily COVID tests and inoculation and everything. I had to have a, when I was on the History Channel program, I had to have a COVID test to even be on the site. It's a rule of filming in Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
So they kept on filming where Hollywood shut down for the better part of a year, and now they're way ahead, you know, in the production level, number of movies and TV programs they're putting out.
Okay, well, yeah, and you know, we can stick with the woo factor a little bit, and yeah, you know, there is a little reference, or just a reference to the little people. We can also get into the.
We don't have the. That's the Cherokee thing. That's after they drink whiskey.
Okay.
You want woo? I mean, we got woo here. We got. I feel like
the catfish.
Well, we got big catfish, yeah, but we got extraterrestrials, and
okay.
And it's part of the Creek tradition that where I live was one of the three places where we had stargates. I don't even know where it is. I was, and in fact, some professors and scientists from Europe came here several years ago, and they did found a gravitational vortex over the part of the valley where the Stargate is. And there's another one. Each place had a round mound that they was on, and so the other two places were near Elberton, Georgia, on the Savannah River, and then at Okmulgee National Historical Park. You're making. There's a round mound there, which was supposedly had a stargate on it.
Wow.
And according to our tradition, we had friendly relations with very tall extraterrestrials who looked like humanoids. They didn't look a whole lot different than us. And on occasion, Creek priests would try to go into the stargate. Some made it, but it was very dangerous for humans to go because the technology is more based for these people, but it was to the Pleiades. And they would, as they were traveling through space, they would see the galaxies and everything, and thus on the symbol for the Creek Wind Clan is a galaxy surrounded by planets and stars. There's no way you know what a galaxy was by looking at the sky. It's only by going out into space and looking back at the galaxies, such as our own, the Milky Way, that you would know that they were of that shape. So, and that's the
cool.
Symbol of the Wind Clan is a picture of basically of space with the sun, stars, the moons, and the galaxies floating around
it. Well, and I think it's in Nancy Red Star's Star Ancestors book. She covers some of the theories of stargates, portals. I think that those were located in Mexico. So there's like the same type of concept and astral traveling or you know, whatever you want to call it, found in Mexico and
mm-hmm.
also found in Georgia, maybe amongst the same people or closely related.
Well, I think it's why they came here. I mean, it's, you know, I think they knew this place was here much earlier. That it was not like they were just heading north. They knew what was here when they were going. And because there are a lot of these cultural, physical connections between the two areas that you don't find elsewhere. And it's very possible the Mayas actually lived here earlier because their migration legend is they came from northern Europe and lived on a place where there was a lot of ice, and they were chased out of where they were by ice giants. They came down the Atlantic coast of North America and then through Georgia and Florida and then crossed the waters until they came to a place that never had snow at all. And that became those people, the modern people.
Okay, and maybe in their travels they encountered the Wog.
Right. You want to talk about the Wog?
We got to work in the cryptid angle too.
Oh, we've got to do all the woo factor now, don't we?
In the last seven, eight minutes we have left in the show.
Yeah, okay. The Wog was, the best we can determine, did exist. It's not a myth, and it shows up being mentioned in several southern states. It was the Eastern American cousin of the Commodore lizard in Indonesia, and every bit as big, maybe bigger. But it was the same type of lizard. It was extremely big, and it was very dangerous. It could bite humans, and it quickly disappeared after the large herds of buffalo and elk disappeared from the state because there was nothing for it to eat. And also the deer population dropped. It ate the carcasses, the rotten carcasses. That's just like the Commodore lizard Komodo lizard in Indonesia. It only eats rotted flesh. So he thought it was a pinto eating the rotted bodies of buffalo and elk, and when they died out, he was just not getting enough nutrition, and so the species died out.
Okay, that makes sense, but, there we are with that, Asian, East Coast type connection that you mentioned does show up in the DNA.
Yeah.
So there's similar species of huge lizard living in two different parts of the world. There's a little bit more of the evidence that we've been talking about of.
Yeah.
Animal and people migrations around
the
world.
We have a kind of diminutive cousin of the big black lizard still, and it lives in areas where there are terrace complexes that the Mayas built. So they brought it up from Central America. It's not as big as the main one, but it's still not a lizard that's native to this area normally. It's a Central American bird. Hunting and egg hunting and whatever lizard.
Okay, cool.
Is that
touched on
enough? I'm trying to think more. Woof. We got into extraterrestrials. We got into giant lizards.
Stargates.
These people are going to think I'm telling a bunch of tall tales, but you'll just have to verify these things are really part of the history books. And what you're bringing up now was actually in history books written by eyewitness accounts. And then the information was not put into modern history books. It was intentionally left out.
With the 4 minutes left, there is something that is fascinating. It's another example of maybe how the founding fathers were actually looking at native cultures when they were getting ideas for the Constitution. But Yeah, we did talk about principal towns a little bit.
Good dog.
And the capitals seem like they changed, and it is in the Constitution that you had 60%. Maybe your dog.
Barking, but we have a herd of apparently a herd of deer coming into the yard, and
hopefully it's not a dog.
They don't like having. They're trying to let me know that we have a herd of deer coming in. Alternatively, could be prowlers or bison or jaguars, but probably it's deer.
Okay. I just hopefully it's not a wog calling up.
Yeah, I hope it's not a wog too. But I guess anything's possible in these mountains. I mean, I have seen here's a woo thing. Jaguarmundi is a type of tropical cat that the textbooks tell you only live in Central America and Mexico. I have seen it in my backyard hunting turkeys. It was definitely a jaguarmundi. It's like a skinny, smaller ocelot. More like a jaguar marking, but skinnier with a long tail, kind of a miniature mountain lion, but with markings like a jaguar. And they're here. And in fact, I have someone else who found one that was hit by a car in Alabama. And they're here. So we have, there's no telling what is up in these mountains that people don't want to miss. And I know we have mountain lions. But I definitely saw a jaguarmundi. Now, I've gotten a video camera that will shoot film at night with a night vision.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to try to come in this winter. I hope I can film some so people get to see them. Beautiful animals. Very sneaky, though.
Oh.
Is that Will Factor?
It's satisfying my curiosity of woo in Georgia. Hopefully the other listeners are enjoying it as well. But
I hope so.
Yeah, we have.
I was afraid it was going to be too boring just talking about words. It varies with individuals. Obviously, I find it fascinating because to me it's like going into a time machine. When I do these studies and I just focus and cut out everything else, it's like going back in time several hundred years, but perhaps other people would not find it that interesting to unravel the histories of the past.
This has been a very informative show, and we're down to about a minute left. Is there a website or a way people can order your books or just go to Amazon?
I have my own website. My publisher maintains the website for me. And just Google luglu.com-Richard Thornton. RICHARDTHORNTON Thornton. And Google will take you to my website set up by the publisher. And I have, I think, about 15 books I've written still available for them. It varies. The older books are going to be obsolete, I'll just be honest with you. Anything written before I've made all these major discoveries up here in the mountains in the last 3 or 4 years is not going to be up to date. And in fact, things have changed so much about Etowah, I'm just waiting to get all the information before I rewrite my book on Etowah Mounds. We have so much more information than I did when I started this journey back in 2006.
Okay. Well, you'll have to come back and talk about the Etowah Mounds. Okay,
I'll be glad to. I can talk about anything. Or the 4,000-year-old stone ring ceremonial center near me that's probably built by people from Scotland.
Okay.
Is that a woo?
We will do that. We're just about out of time, so I just want to thank you, Richard, for being our guest. Thanks, Barbara, for producing the show, and we'll see everyone next week. Thank you. Good night.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure. Have a great weekend. Huh? Bye-bye.
Yep.